Loaded episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show coming up next. Welcome to the Kevin O'Connor Show. Joining me again today is Tom Haberstroh to talk about everything going around the NBA. But before we get to Tom, I'm bringing on my friend Gibson Piper from Half Court Hoops to discuss Thursday night's games. Gibson, you might know him from Half Court Hoops on social media and from YouTube. He does these amazing breakdown videos. One of the smartest dudes that I know covering the NBA. And we had a really good conversation breaking down Thursday's games. So here's my conversation with Gibson Piper after Father John Misty. All right, Gibson, welcome to the show. Feels good to have the NBA back, doesn't it?
Man, it feels really good. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it, man. So we're going to talk about the Thursday night games. The moment I'm going to remember most from tonight's openers is the Chet Holmgren block sequence. You had Jokic posting up, Chet Holmgren defending, then the Thunder defense was swarming, helping off of the Nuggets non-shooters. Chet gets the block, hustles up the floor, Chet gets the dunk, primal scream, Thunder bench going crazy, and OKC won that game in Denver, 102-87. The Nuggets had shot 7 of 39 from 3. Helping off of them was representative in that play. Chet had 25 points, 14 rebounds, 5 assists, 4 blocks, 2 steals, all NBA-level performance. I'm going to remember that sequence, Gibson, because it felt like a symbolic passing of the torch. The Nuggets, no longer contenders, and the Thunder, the new West favorites. Am I on the right track there and feeling that way?
I think a little bit, but I mean that moment was definitely the moment that I like jumped out of my seat. Like it was emphatic, right?
And I screamed.
It was a microcosm of sort of that whole game where Jokic was struggling, the Nuggets were struggling, and the Thunder were just kind of rolling and made it look easy.
Yes, exactly. They absolutely did. And I feel like with the Denver, though, that side of things, like I said, they were 7 of 39 from 3 in the game. And that's going to be an issue for them this entire season, I feel, because you have Russell Westbrook airballs his first shot with Denver. You have all these iffy or non-shooters, Peyton Watson, Christian Brown, Aaron Gordon. Jokic himself is not necessarily an elite guy over the course of his full career. He's had some elite stretches. But for Denver, I thought Oklahoma City, with their defense, completely exposed that. And so I'm a little bit concerned about that from the Denver side of things. You seem a little bit less so concerned than I am about Denver's depth behind Jokic, their lack of shooting.
Yeah, they didn't take like 50% of their shots from three. I think they ended at around like 35% of their shots total were from three-point range, which is lower than league average last year. So it's not like they were just jacking up a ton of threes and they were taking bad shots. I think Michael Porter Jr. missed a lot of open looks that he'll normally hit. And I think Malone is playing the long game, especially with like the front office where they're almost playing like a game of chicken, where he clearly wants more vets and more like hardened guys who know how to play basketball, who can make an open three. And then as time goes on, he can go to the front office and go see, right? And sort of play that game where he can say, we need more vets who can shoot, who can handle, who can do different things. Lineups could be better, sure, but I think overall it's not that concerning. It's more concerning the volume of who took the shots. Like Russell Westbrook should not be your second leading three-point attempt at 6, right? Like he should not be in that position at all.
Crazy. And I think the thing is he's taking those shots because they are wide open shots. And so Denver is taking what is the quote-unquote good quality open shot opportunity, but he's open for good reason because he's one of the worst shooters at a high volume in NBA history. And you mentioned lineups. The lineup, like, it just makes me think about that first half, I think early second quarter or something like that. It was when Jokic was off the floor, the Jamal Murray-led bench lineups. We had Julian Strother, Russell Westbrook, Peyton Watson, and Dario Saric. And that's where Oklahoma City really built out their lead. And so you talk about this game of chicken between Michael Malone, the Nuggets head coach, and Calvin Booth, the Nuggets general manager. That's been reported on. Zach Lowe had mentioned it on his podcast. You know, months ago, I had, you know, talked about it after Denver was eliminated as well with some of the public quotes last season where Malone, who was a little bit passive aggressive towards the front office. And I do think there could be an element to that. I think you could be on to something. But at the same time, for Denver, where are the solutions? Where are the solutions? You are lacking trade assets. You are unless you're trading Michael Porter Jr., who's already your best shooter, you don't have a lot of guys with a ton of value. So that's where we're like with Denver, why I'm a little bit in panic mode here, because if you're stacking them up against the best teams in the West, the way I'm feeling is like, if Jokic somehow were to get this Nuggets roster to 50 wins, he's probably the MVP. Like if you can get this team to 50 wins, that's incredible. That's one of the most greatest achievements of your career. I just really worry about the losses that they've experienced. KCP gone, Bruce Brown gone, and the young guys have not developed in part because of that game of chicken you're talking about with Malone not playing the rookies last year. And you know what? Maybe Booth was wrong in even drafting them in the first place. Maybe these guys just aren't good.
Yeah, I think it's a fine line, especially, I mean, it's game one, right? So we're going to be, but we already knew this going into game one, right? Everybody, the whole offseason was like, well, the Nuggets aren't going to shoot the three ball very well. And then they didn't shoot the three ball very well. So in reality, it's actually only up from here. Right, they're going to exceed any expectations we've already placed on them.
I hope it's up, Gibson. I hope.
I mean, yeah, you do hope. But
it's
I
like
think
saying about the Celtics after opening night, it's only down from here. Is it? It could be up from there too. They could hit 30 in a game.
Maybe. But I think the hard part is, and we won't really know because the stars didn't, like, Jokic did not have his Jokic level game.
No,
right. 6 of 13 overall, 16 points. Like, he did not score the ball at the elite level that I think he needs to make this a top 10 offensive team or even an average offensive team. Jamal Murray, 4 of 14, didn't do anything really important when the game mattered, right? So if you take, you know, your two best players on any team who aren't going to play at a MVP or at least an all-star borderline all-NBA level, like, yeah, you're going to look bad and it doesn't really matter what else happens besides that.
Sure. And I mean, here's the other side of it, though. I don't think Oklahoma City was nearly at their peak in this game either. They were 8 of 36 from three, missed a ton of open shot opportunities. SGA, as awesome as he was in certain moments, he had the beautiful crossover on Aaron Gordon for the filthy layup. He had the pull three, some beautiful assist, the dump off when he drew two defenders to Kayson Wallace for the layup. SGA was awesome, and yet he was only 11 of 24. I feel like Oklahoma City has another gear that they can reach, especially when they get Hartenstein back later this season. And I think when some of these young guys in the rotation continue to improve over the course of the season, whether that's Jalen Williams or SGA or Chet, who was already awesome tonight, or even some of the bench guys. So I think the OKC tonight showed they are already at the top of the West. And yet it's like, oh, wait a minute, they're not where they should be even in April.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to be impressed with them playing a borderline bad game as well, like a poor shooting game and not at, you know, at their highest offensive peak. And it did look like at times one team was playing modern five out NBA basketball. The other team, the Nuggets, were not, right? Now, there are more than one ways to win a game, but there was a stark contrast in style of play, especially in the half court. And with Jokic, you normally would see the Nuggets running and cutting and splitting and having multiple actions off of him. And it just looked like the Thunder were able to play smaller and get away on the defensive end and also, you know, stretch Jokic out on the floor on their offensive end. And so, yeah, I was really impressed. And the interesting thing was, you know, the Nuggets, you could see them trying different things throughout the game. Like, they started off by switching basically every ball screen and then rotating guys over to Chet. And the problem with that was that made Jokic guard in space and have to close out to a player like Isaiah Joe, right? Or Wiggins, who is all of a sudden incredible at attacking closeouts and finishing in the paint. And so it's just a very interesting thing, because then the Nuggets had to go to a dropper, like a back coverage with Jokic, and then Chet was open on the roll. So the Thunder have multiple ways they're attacking, you know, the Nuggets without actually hitting probably additional 5 to 6 threes that were just wide open they normally hit. It was impressive.
I think you're hitting on something with Oklahoma City. Like, it's why a lot of people are picking them to make the finals. It's their attack points. They have so many different ways that they can play. They can slow it down and do an ISO with SGA. They can play with cutting and movement and motion. They can have Chet Holmgren bring the ball up the floor himself if necessary. They have so many different guys who can dribble, pass, shoot. And I think they're the team in the West that has the most of them. Boston is the team in the East with the most of them. Is that fair to say, you think, when you kind of stack up all the teams in the league? OKC is right up there with Boston.
Yeah, I think they're the top two, just as far as like one through eight for sure. I mean, like you look at they're both those rosters. There's not really anybody that you could say, okay, ignore him or like leave him open. Because even if you ignore Dort or you ignore Caruso, they can all of a sudden become ball screeners and go into a short roll like the Celtics attack, right? They're cutting on the baseline. Yes. They have lots of ways and a variety of attacks that they can get creative with. And I don't think there's anybody else that really stacks up as far as like, especially on offense for sure. Those two teams are probably far ahead of third place too.
The Minnesota Timberwolves and the Sacramento Kings also played on Thursday night. It was the Wolves' second game of the season. It was the Kings' first game, their home opener of the season as well. The Wolves won that game 117 to 115. Kings were up for most of the game until late in the third quarter when Anthony Edwards took over. They carried that into the fourth quarter and beat Sacramento. One interesting thing from this game, Anthony Edwards' shot diet. In preseason, I had said on this podcast, Ant, it feels like he's, you know, trying to get a rhythm from the three-point line, taking a ton of threes. In preseason, he had shot 56 total shots, 37 of them were threes. I thought that was just by design. I'm going to get myself going that way. I'm practicing things. But then in the first game of the season for Minnesota, he took 25 shots, 13 threes. And then Thursday night, 24 shots, 15 threes. And he hit some big ones. But just kind of an interesting trend here that Anthony Edwards last year, 34% of his total shots were threes. So far this season, 62% of Anthony Edwards' shots were threes. What do you make of this, Gibson? What's going on with Ant? Is it working? Is this a good thing? Is this like, I don't know how to feel. It's just weird.
He's getting them up. I will say that
he's
letting it go. And the interesting part is, you know, a lot of them are not necessarily like where you think of like a 3-point shooter, like an off screen action or like, you know, coming, you know, in a spot up or lifting or off the ball. You know, a lot of them are coming off like self-created. I don't have the ISO numbers that I've looked up, but just watching the game tonight, it was like a lot of, okay, like, I guess I'm shooting this three now. And it's probably a byproduct of the Timberwolves are one of the easier teams to switch against right now, just because with their lineup constructions, even when they're going to like a smaller lineup, they don't have elite 3-point shooting. You know, even when you go to like a Nas and Randall five lineup, there's not like a ton of shooters out there because Ant's not really like a shooter. He's, you know, handle it, get a feel, you know, bounce, make a move. And DiVincenzo really isn't firing at all cylinders right now as far as three-point shooting. Jaden McDaniels is obviously not. And so you kind of have to have somebody who can shoot. And Anthony Edwards is like, cool, I guess it's me right now. And he's just letting it go.
And Julius Randle, you know, at least for Minnesota, he did shoot well tonight. He was 5 of 6 from 3, 13 of 17 from the floor for 33 points. It was a great Randle performance. And I don't want to, you know, Minnesota wins the game. Great second half comeback. Their defense was great against Sacramento in the second half. But I felt like in the first half of that game, despite Randall going off, it didn't feel sustainable to me. It just felt clunky. Like, I just feel like they are not where they need to be to get to the same level that they did last season. Do you see silver linings in Minnesota's offensive performance through two games in the preseason? Or do you kind of share that same, I don't want to say like I'm not pressing a panic switch like I am with Denver, but just a little bit concerning right now where the rhythm is with Minnesota's offense.
Yeah, it's so I made a video, I think, 2 years ago when the first Gobert trade happened with Cat and Gobert. And I called it like too big trouble or something like that. And it was like obvious that the Cat and Gobert pairing was just like not good at all, especially that first year. You got better, sure. But you could see like the theory of what it was supposed to look like. It just would never look like that. Even at its peak in the playoffs, it just never looked great. With this, you know, the hardest thing with the Randall performance tonight is he's playing the Kings, right? Not going to be a top 10 defensive team and have nobody to match up with him specifically. They're playing Sabonis at the five, so they're playing DeRozan on Randall.
Very, very small.
Like, it's a perfect Julius Randall, let me go get my 30 team, right? And so it's hard. I mean, 5 of 6 from three was really impressive. I think he's going to stay at his normal level. He stayed his whole career. But for the most part, you could see how it's going to work in terms of playing him at the five in the second lineup better than playing with next to Gobert. Like I wrote down when I first saw the lineup against the Lakers and then tonight, it just doesn't look good with McDaniels and Conley out there next to Randall and Gobert. Like it just doesn't, I don't think it works. It, like my brain sees that and it doesn't work right. Right. It's like this doesn't, it's not going to work at the highest levels, right. Against the best of the best teams. And you can see that.
Why do you think it wouldn't work at the highest of levels?
It's just what'll happen is like Ant will create an advantage. And the whole point of the NBA, especially in the playoffs, is find the opponent's weakest spot and just keep going after that, get that advantage, and then just keep that advantage going for the rest of the possession. And so you need players in those offensive possessions to be able to make quicker decisions. And they need to be able to shoot, drive, and then pass, right? Those are like the easiest. We teach that at a high school level every day. They definitely teach the NBA level. And so what'll happen is you'll get Ant create an advantage, and then he'll kick it out to McDaniels, who's always indecisive whether to shoot or not right now because he's still figuring out if he's actually a good shooter or not. Spoiler, he's not that good of a shooter right now. And so what he does, he's like, should I shoot it? I'm kind of open. And then he goes, no, I shouldn't. And then he'll either drive it or lose that advantage. Then he'll, or if it's passed to Randall, Randall's like, oh, I should, nope. And then he's like, I got DeRozan on me. I'm going to back him down. And then Conley's just not the same level of player he was. And yeah, it's fine. So the only player that really, to me, fits that mold would be Reed, right? And so if you play Reed, you can't play Randall, Reed, and Gobert. And then you can't play, you know, if you play Randall and Reed, it's still a little clunky. So you have Ant who's creating all these advantages, but he's the only player who really can. Right. Besides them setting a ball screen, Ant's the only guy who can actually say, you know what? I'm a one man offense. You can't guard me. You start at the end of the game. They had to double him to get it out of his hands and
playmaking so then, all through the third quarter as yeah. well. I mean, he made some beautiful passes. Ant was very good playmaking.
Fantastic. But also Ant's first mindset is go get a bucket. I'm a scorer, which is fine. I mean, we saw Tatum go through his whole evolution for the first, you know, few years of his career. And so whatever happens is like a couple times tonight, Ant would drive, he would kick to McDaniels, and they could play the 2-on-1 on the weak side, right? Which is just play in the corner, player on the wing, read the defense, make an extra pass, and shoot an open three. And half the time they would catch the ball, and by the time they caught it and then they looked and held it, the other defender could rotate, and then the offense kind of stalled. So then it gets to Randall, and then Gobert's low, and then Randall's backing down, and then Ant's standing in the middle of nowhere. It just looks bad from like an optic standpoint, even though it could be an efficient offensive play with Randall going 13-17 tonight.
It's just not sustainable. And that's where Minnesota needs to figure out that rhythm and that flow over the course of the season. And I know, you know, I don't know if Randall would accept this, but I do think moving Naz Reid into the starting lineup, Randall to the bench, letting Randall pulverize smaller bench units could allow him to have more games like he did tonight against that smaller Kings front line. And I think with Sacramento, this game was representative of why I think the Kings are just a play-in team at best. They are just too small. They don't have the defense. They are more of a play-in team, and they're fun. They're exciting to watch. I love DeMar DeRozan. I've loved that dude for years. Keegan Murray looks like he could actually be improved. I love that Sabonis is shooting threes. That's important. He was 3-for-4 from three tonight. That's very encouraging. That's important for their half-court offense, especially adding DeMar DeRozan, who's more of a mid-range guy. But I just don't think they have nearly enough defensively where you can't even stop this Minnesota team that right now is not clicking with their flow. So I'm a little worried about the Kings side of things. And do you have any first impressions of Sacramento, Gibson?
I think they are who we thought they were, right? Yeah. I think they're fun. They're really fun to watch. They get up and down the court. DeRozan and Fox are a good pairing together, like we thought, or like at least I thought, you know, DeRozan going from Toronto where he could play in that system to being the system almost in San Antonio and Chicago and now kind of plugging right in. It's pretty cool to see him though be able to be in those positions where he was the guy in Toronto, then he fit in with Nurse, took over in that system. Then he went to, you know, Chicago and was the guy. But yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, like there's no really any above average defenders on this team that are going to play significant minutes in the playoffs, right? Well, yes. if you don't have that, then you're just, hopefully you can outscore teams, which it can be fun. But yeah, they're, you know, at the most, they're probably an 8 seed in my opinion. You know, in the regular season, you get offensive teams that do a lot better than they should just because off nights and back to backs and things you don't want to play. Like the Pacers are a perfect example of that. You just don't want to play those teams, you know, when you're tired and on the road. And so they can steal some wins doing that. But I think I don't think there's anything wrong with being a fun team who's an 8-9 seed in the NBA either.
No, nothing wrong with that at all. And sometimes those teams can end up being, you know, top seeds at some point in the future if the right moves are made. The other game tonight that I want to talk about with you, Gibson, is the Spurs-Mavericks. The Mavericks just completely shut down the Chris Paul, Victor Wembanyama pick and roll. First possession of the game. We saw it right off the bat. Chris Paul was being defended by Klay Thompson. Victor Wembanyama defended by PJ Washington. And the Spurs set two screens at the top of the key for Barnes and for Chris Paul with Barnes and Wemby. Mavs switched that. Then Wemby screened again for Chris Paul. The Mavericks switched that as well. And then Luka ended up defending Wembanyama in that sequence, and the Mavericks were okay with that to open the game. They were okay with it pretty much all night. Wemby passed out of it to a missed three. And then in the third quarter, a play that sticks in my mind with that Maverick switch defense was a high ball screen between Chris Paul and Wemby. Maverick switched PJ Washington onto Chris Paul, Klay Thompson onto Victor Wembanyama. And then as Wemby rolled to the rim for the mismatch, the Mavericks pre-switched that and got Gafford on Victor Wembanyama. And then Gafford did a good job defending him from a post fade. So I thought the Mavericks did a really good job at just executing a clear game plan for containing Chris Paul and containing Victor Wembanyama. It feels like they're going to be right back to their elite defensive ways. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, completely agree. I did I did all the previews for the NBA teams. I did an extensive breakdown of the Mavericks defense and basically how all their switching, like you're talking about, keeps Luka and Kyrie out of those situations. And this is something that Klay has been doing with the Warriors since like 2015-16, where they would have them switch the ball screen, Draymond kicks the guy out of the post, and then all of a sudden you have no advantage. And that is the downside to adding Chris Paul in 2024, right? Where he is the perfect pick and roll partner for Wembanyama, until they just switch it. And then you have, okay, are you gonna let Chris Paul ISO? Teams are not gonna care about that right now. Unfortunately, it is what it is. He's an older
slower footed. He's not as quick anymore.
It's fine. Like he's not that stage of his career. You know, 8 years ago, you don't want as devastating to switch against Chris Paul. But yeah, the recipe was simple. They basically just switched every ball screen. And then whenever Wemby rolled in the elbow or the post, they just whoever the big was, usually guarding a non-threat like Sohan off the ball, just kick that guy out, and all of a sudden you've got Gafford matched up on Wemby. You've got Lively on Wemby, and they didn't. And honestly, they didn't even care that much when Wemby rolled against like Luka or Klay. They were just like, yeah, cool, throw the ball in the post. And a big thing they did was, or at least what it looked like on the film, was every time Wemby rolled, they basically attacked his hips in his center of gravity and just tried to push him 2 or 3 feet out. Right. So he couldn't roll into a deep seal. So he couldn't get as close to the basket. So the switch could be easier. But if he caught it, they could trap a little bit easier too, and a little bit further out. So that way he couldn't catch it in like a scoring threat.
Is Wemby kind of facing the young Kristaps Porzingis issue right now, where KP would be defended by some smaller guys and his only move really was to shoot over the top? He didn't have anything else. Wemby, I mean, as brilliant as he is, even in, you know, the opener on Thursday, he hit some impressive shots in those post-ups, but he was only 5-for-18 from the floor. He has not been a super efficient post player going back to last season. Is that kind of like really, people talk about the shooting with Wemby, 1-of-8 from three, but is it actually post play that's most important for him to develop considering those switching defenses?
I don't know if it's the most important because NBA teams don't post up like that anymore. Right. Like it's just not.
Well, Jokic and Bede, it becomes a super efficient play for those guys.
Yeah, but it's not a high enough volume where they're doing it all the time. Right. Like I think the most post touches in the NBA last year per game was like 20, 25. Right. So you're talking about at the most 20% of your team's possession if you're like a high volume player. So yes and no. Like being able to have a quick catch and maybe a quicker go to post move. Sure. But I think it's more important for him to develop like a face-up game out of the mid-post, right? And you saw him later in the game, he kind of got more comfortable and was coming off and hitting some early shots, either off a roll or in like ISO against smaller players, sure. I think the biggest difference between him and like a guy like Porzingis is Wemby's handle is much more advanced than what Kristaps was at this point in his career, especially second year,
yes.
Where Wemby can use a ball screen, he can handle, he can actually make like real actual moves on the move, which is much more important than it is having a post-up game in today's NBA. So I think adding post-up is fine. Maybe just like a quick catch left hook, quick catch right hook, right? But I think more importantly, it would be like the mid-post face-up game where he can really use his athleticism, his quick handle for a quick move, almost like you see where Bam has kind of evolved into now, where Bam now catches face, jab, attack, you know, and have different counters out of that than necessarily because Wemby's not a center of gravity post-up guy. Like Luke, like a Jokic, Luka, Embiid, those guys are, we can take you down to the post. I'm bigger than you. I'm stronger than you. And I can just back you down and then make a move. Whereas Wemby, he's not, and I don't know he'll ever be that sort of power, you know, big where he can actually back down like that versus maybe a face-up game where he can be use his actual skill at that size.
On the other side of that with Dallas, it was Klay Thompson's debut with the Dallas Mavericks. He was great. He had 22 points, 7 rebounds, 3 steals, played good defense, including some of the switch defense on Victor, as you said. And I thought the most telling sequence in that game for the Mavericks was the play in which Klay hit a wide open three. Luka passed him the ball, turned around, ran back on defense before the shot even fell. That must be a relief for Luka to have an outlet like Klay Thompson after everything he experienced last season.
Yeah, it must feel really good, right? To know that you're passing to maybe the second best shooter of all time, or at least, you know, one of the top five shooters of all time. And that came off a Spain action where Klay would normally set the back screen and it caused a lot of confusion too, which was cool to see them use Klay in those areas. But I mean, Klay is one of the easier players to add to any system. Like shooting translates wherever you go. Like if you're a good enough shooter, like you just are, you're fine, right? We've actually saw Tim Hardaway Jr. first play for the Pistons, right? Came off for a three. And so, you know, it was easy for offense. It was easy for defense. Luka and Kyrie are both probably relieved that they can just, hey, I know he's open. I'll pass him. The interesting part is going to be like down the line when Klay isn't like at this level all the time, right? Where he's not as because he had games in Golden State last year, stretches in Golden State that were not good, right? Like he had stretches like this where he was awesome, and he had stretches that he was not good. So he was kind of hot and cold. And you could see in the first half, he started to overstep a little bit of what I think his ideal role would be, which is just, I'm a shooter, I'm a screener for Luka, I'm a spacer, like I'm a back screener, off ball player. He had a couple of possessions where like he came off a ball screen and like missed it. And I think he airballed the next three right after that. When Luka was like open at the top, and I was like, ooh, that's interesting. Like that was weird. But then it kind of the rest of the way, he kind of was like, all right, I guess that was my one opportunity. And then he settled back in to kind of like the normal role. But yeah, he was great. And Klay's one of my favorite players of all time to watch. So it's cool to see him, you know, having fun on the basketball court again.
And I think defensively, there will be greater tests for him individually as well. Like San Antonio, San Antonio just feels slow to me. Like you mentioned, like Chris Paul at his age, you know, Victor is not where he will be in the prime of his career. Like they just feel slow and sluggish. Like when it comes to shot creation, they don't feel like an athletic, quick team to me. And I kind of wish Victor had that around him at this stage of his career, but. So for the Dallas side of things, that's where greater tests will come. And for San Antonio, it's like, I don't know about playing this year. I don't know. I'm not so sure there.
Yeah, it didn't look great. I think when Vassell comes back and hopefully slots into that, maybe Sohan spot helps on offense, I think that will alleviate a little bit of my concerns because it just didn't look like you couldn't do anything because nobody's going to respect Chris Paul from three and Sohan from three. And it's like, all right, Wemby's not like that level of 3-point shooter. Like he was like 33% last year. So it's like, all right, the whole like the I took a couple of screenshots and the entire paint where Wemby had the ball was just packed. Like he couldn't go anywhere. So they look slow because they had nowhere to go. Right. That's part of the problem where it's like you can't play fast if people are always consistently in your way. And I will say, we've been saying, you know, for the past few years almost, like the Mavericks defense is going to struggle because of Luka and because Kyrie, they can't guard anybody. And I've seen time and time again that staff come up with great game plans, great execution, and they added a high IQ player in Klay who knows sort of that defensive system. So I'm way less worried than I thought I would be when I was like, oh, no, Derrick Jones Jr. Like, oh, no, like who's going to guard anybody? They're creative enough and they have enough rim protection, I think, behind that they'll be OK, especially in the regular season. But in the playoffs, we saw them make the finals. And I think we all agreed they added better players and upgrades to the system they already had. So I'm really not that worried about the Mavericks defense at all.
Yeah. I mean, you're 100% right. And like they have a great game planning. Jason Kidd, Sean Sweeney, their lead assistant, he had interviewed for the Pistons head coaching job, didn't get it, but I think he's going to be at some point a future head coach, really a great defensive mind, people around the league say, and it's the evidence is on the floor with their game planning, as you said, with hiding or in, masking some of the concerns individually with Luka and Kyrie Irving. Gibson, we can find your stuff at Half Court Hoops on social media, on YouTube. Got anything planned coming up?
Yeah, I'm starting the early season team breakdown. So I'll be doing, not this week, but next week, the Suns, Lakers, you know, all the, some Beautiful. Of the newer coaches and stuff, diving into JJ's playbook, which has been awesome so far. So, yeah.
Awesome, Gibson. Appreciate you joining me tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Kev.
Next up, we have Tom Haverstraw. All right, now joining me, as he does every Friday, is Yahoo Sports contributor Tom Haverstraw. Tom, how you doing today, man?
Pumped and jacked, as always.
I love to hear it, Tom. It makes me happy. It gets my day started. We're very, very, very happily, because you know that's my Pete Carroll stolen phrase, late 90s Patriots head coach. We're recording this on Thursday morning, this section of the podcast. So we're following up on Wednesday night's games. We got news this morning that DeJounte Murray officially did fracture his left hand. The Pelicans, they started their season, no Zion Williamson. So we're not even going to get to see Zion and their new acquisition, DeJounte Murray, play together for who knows how long. This sometimes can be a month plus long recovery. Tom, I think with DeJounte Murray, his reputation has been a little bit up and down in the eyes of NBA fans, but there's no denying that this is a big injury for New Orleans. He led the team in touches on Wednesday night. He had 80 touches. He led the team in possession time. He touched the ball for 7 minutes, but I don't think this means that it's entirely over for the Pelicans in this early part of the season, because we're just going to see point Zion Williamson right now.
Point center Zion Williamson. Mm-hmm. Like I'm fully embracing the point center Zion Williamson era, because the last game where they get the injury from DeJounte Murray, they're starting Daniel Tice. This all screams like, hey, you know how you fill the point guard position and the center position? You throw out Zion Williamson. Right, Kevin? Like, it feels like we're stepping into not just point Zion Williamson era. We need to have both of them, because they have a need at both positions. And so DeJounte Murray, if they're going to reach the highest points of their season, they need DeJounte Murray. So last season, Kevin, when you had point Zion with no CJ McCollum, no Alvarado, no Kieran Lewis Jr., you had Zion Williamson at point center, essentially. 26 points, 6 assists, 6 rebounds per 75 possessions, and the Pelicans were outscoring opponents by 3 points every 100 possessions. So we already have the script here for the New Orleans Pelicans going forward without DeJounte Murray is a lot more possessions with Zion Williamson leading the cause, and I think they're going to be okay. It just stinks that maybe we need to get some voodoo dolls going in New Orleans, use that some of that black magic to make sure that they get healthier going forward.
I mean, I think they have a lot of those voodoo dolls. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe there's too many of those at this point already with the Pelicans. They can't get anybody healthy. And with Zion, look, they're just skating on even thinner ice now. That's the concern. You lose DeJounte Murray, yes, you're going to have more points. Zion, everything you said is 100% true about the stats and the way he's produced. I remember even during the Stan Van Gundy era, when Stan Van Gundy first put him at point guard, and like suddenly he's averaging 30 points and 7 assists, and he's looking like an MVP level candidate, but it fizzles out all the time with Zion because of durability. And so if you lose Zion for any amount of time, whether it's due to illness like it was on game one or injury like it has been in the past, suddenly you're that team that's on the outside looking in of the play-in race in the early part of the year. And that's where the concern is when you don't have Zion on the floor, whether he's healthy in a game, it's those 13 minutes without him, or if he's absent for any other reason. That's the concern for New Orleans.
Yeah, but the upside here too, Kevin, is Brandon Ingram has a chance to really show out here. Not just to prove that he's worth big money, but without DeJounte Murray, he's going to have the ball in his hands a lot more, and he can create as kind of this, you know, big shooter, scorer, creator that can have, you know, a lot of opportunities with the ball in his hands and creating. And other teams are going to look at that and say, wait, there's this another layer to Brandon Ingram that we didn't feel like he had that in his arsenal. And now you get the opportunity to showcase that. And so in a weird way, I remember Eric Spoelstra, when Chris Bosh got hurt, you know, he always said, like, these injuries could be an opportunity. Take this adversity and turn it into an opportunity. And with DeJounte Murray out, this is an opportunity for the Pelicans to really see what they have in Brandon Ingram and maybe get a little bit more creative with Zion.
That's a really smart point. I think with New Orleans, that is the silver lining here. You get Ingram into a role where he can be asked to do more, especially if they have to stagger. And in those minutes, Zion's not on the floor. You have Ingram, McCollum kind of sharing those shot creation responsibilities. So there is a silver lining there. Maybe you raise Ingram's value and you're able to flip him. But at the same time, you know, the does seem like Willie Green, their head coach, had said he wants him shooting 6 or 7 threes per game. He had 5 in the season opener. He also took 23 shots. It's actually a lower 3-point rate that he had last season. But we'll see if he ends up taking more threes or if now this requires him to run more pick and roll. Also in Wednesday night's game, the Sixers got blasted by the Bucks, 124-109. That was a national TV game. We had reports earlier in the night from Shams Charania, who said the NBA is likely to begin an investigation later this week into the Philadelphia 76ers surrounding the player participation of all NBA center Joel Embiid. And then he later wrote, "It's typical for the NBA to review a team anytime a superstar player misses a nationally televised game as per the player participation policy." So, Tom, I ask you, if this is typical, as Shams wrote, what do you make of this actually being reported? Is like this like a threat from the NBA to say, hey, no screwing around here? Like, what's the reason for this if this is typical?
So now you're going to see left knee injury, left knee soreness going forward. The management word is going to be out. That's what's going to happen going forward. Is if you just said that Joel Embiid is going to be out with left knee soreness or what have you, I don't think there's an investigation. I think that management word is a stigma. It is a buzzword. It is going to trigger some sort of investigation by the league office. And you're going to see, I think, going forward, teams getting rid of that word management so they can avoid this situation. And it's also, Kevin, an admission that the Philadelphia 76ers view the regular season as an 82-game preseason. That's it. This entire season is all about just getting to the playoffs in one piece. Paul George, a long history of injury issues, and then he had the bone bruise in the preseason. Joel Embiid, we don't even have to go through the laundry list of issues that he's had staying healthy, but it is in direct conflict of an NBA that wants to have star players in uniform for their fans to watch. Tyrese Maxey is a star player, all-star player. But fans want to see Paul George, Joel Embiid playing for their team. And unfortunately, Daryl Morey and the medical staff decided for their best chances to win a championship, they're not going to play opening night. They're going to sit. And the NBA is not happy about it.
I mean, understandably so, they're not happy about it. It's a nationally televised game. It's against the Bucks. It's against Giannis, Damian Lillard, other high-profile players. And the game was a complete dud. If you're a casual fan tuning in, if you're a Bucks fan, if you're happy. But other than that, it just wasn't an interesting game. You're probably tuning into League Pass instead, hoping to get more entertainment there. But ultimately, I do think within that game, we saw the concern from the Philly side in the sense that you at least need one of those guys, Paul George or Joel Embiid, to be competitive against the other best teams in the league. Or else, you talk about setting yourself up for success in the postseason by, you know, having these guys on bubble wrap the whole year, treating it like an 82-game preseason. As you said, that's a good way to put it. But you also do need to have good seeding. Like, you don't want to be the 7 seed and or the 8 seed and have to be in the play-in. It's really competitive in both conferences right now.
100%. I thought the same thing. Is if they are going to take off for 15 games, so the Philadelphia 76ers have 15 back-to-backs, and in a great story from ESPN.com's Tim Bontemps, he reported, Daryl Morey is basically saying, I don't expect them to play in any of those back-to-backs because we want to make sure they're not at undue injury risk for the postseason. So 15 games for Paul George and Joel Embiid that you can just wipe off for them. Then you throw in Tyrese Maxey, who's shouldering the scoring load for this team, And like, how much are they going to get from Eric Gordon and Kelly Oubre consistently on a night-to-night basis in the Eastern Conference?
Two points on six shots in the opener for Eric Gordon, 21 points on 18 shots for Oubre. Oubre is not going to have, you know, higher scoring games like that every night.
Exactly. And it's on 18 shots. Okay. So like when we're talking about Kelly Oubre, it's going to be, you know, a feast or famine type of experience. Exactly. That's why he's bounced around the league. He has found a home in Philadelphia and he's been really good for them, but you can't expect him to be the number two on a really good playoff team. So I do think that there is a risk here, not to overreact to a game one, but if you play with your food, you know, sometimes you're going to be left out of the playoffs. We've seen LeBron James, Stephen Curry missed the playoffs entirely. And I think that is at stake here if the Philadelphia 76ers don't get serious about playing in the regular season.
Sure. I mean, granted, Philly's missing Joel Embiid and Paul George. I was impressed by the Bucks on the other side of that game. I thought Gary Trent's defense on Tyrese Maxey was amazing the entire game, chasing him around through a bunch of screens, off ball, on ball. It felt like he was stuck to his side constantly. And when he wasn't, he was steering him right into Brook Lopez, who looked like his all defensive caliber level self protecting the rim. So I thought Milwaukee's defensive game plan that they had against the depleted Sixers roster was executed to perfection. And Gary Trent Jr., more than anybody else on that Bucks side of things, just stuck out to me after a year of just watching these guys on the perimeter just let people get to the rim with ease. It's like, oh my God, they have some energy, a potential stopper on that end of the floor. It just looked way better in comparison to what the Bucks had received last season from their perimeter guys.
Kevin, last year, Tyrese Maxey is going off for 50 in that game.
Oh yeah, no doubt about it.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just they look connected.
It's open
defensively.
Shot after open shot last season.
Exactly. And getting out in transition, like that would be a nightmare for this Milwaukee defense, is they're at times just awful at getting back in transition and running back and trying to get the opponent into a set defense. And on the season opener on national television, they got back. And you look at the numbers here. I pulled it up on Synergy. Their transition defense, the Milwaukee Bucks, allowed just 0.68 points per transition play and only 15% of the time. So those two numbers are hugely important, not just how well you stopped them in transition, but how often you let them get into transition. And both of those numbers are about half of what they were last year. So when you're looking at the Philadelphia 76ers without Joel Embiid, without Paul George, you know that Nick Nurse in that locker room is looking at that Milwaukee Bucks defense and saying, get out in transition and beat them down the floor. We are going to run them out of the gym with Tyrese Maxey. And he had one of his most inefficient games of the last couple of years. And so Tyrese Maxey, last year, 50 points, no doubt. This game in the season opener, he was bottled up, Gary Trent Jr., but also just collectively, Doc Rivers got this team to run back on defense, and they did a great job.
I mean, I look forward to seeing the Bucks play there. You know, they have Chicago and then Brooklyn, but next week they have Boston, they have Memphis. Those will be two really good games for us to talk about on next Friday's episode. It's like a really good barometer, I think, for where this Bucks team is. But overall, first impression from opening night for the Bucks, I was very impressed. I was not impressed by the Rockets blowing an 18-point second half lead against a Hornets team that didn't have Brandon Miller. And for Houston, like we talked about this team before the season began, Tom, and how they could be a playoff team and all that. Blowing an 18-point lead against the Hornets cannot happen in the Western Conference. It doesn't matter if it's just game one. Losses like this can't keep piling up when the West is so loaded and everybody's going to be competing for the playoffs really excited from the Blazers. You need to win these games or you're going to be that team that's just not in the play-in. So from the Houston side of things, it just felt like a repeat of something we saw so many times last season. Is this a sign that we are indeed going to see the same type of Houston team, or am I overreacting to just a game one loss and I should chill the hell out right now?
I was watching the Blazers-Warriors game, working that game, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw the Houston score, and I was like, oh, yeah, my prediction that they're going to make the leap this year is great. Like, man, I'm looking smart right now. And then I look up like 20 minutes later, and the Charlotte Hornets are blowing them out in the second half, and they win the game. I got to tell you, LaMelo Ball, when he's got it going, is top five league pass, top five most exciting player in the game. The stuff
Dude, he's
he does,
so fun.
It's so fun. I mean, yeah. And I don't even know if it's effective, but it's fun. Like, there's times
it was effective, Kev, where, like, last night. The step back,
it was
threes,
effective, but there,
he followed up on one of his missed threes with a layup looking like Larry Bird.
He shot it and he was like, oh, that is way off. And then it just bounced off the backboard. And he was the first one to get to the ball and he laid it in. But there was another time, Kevin, where he was looking. He did a no-look pass from half court where he looked at the other side, other basket. He looked at the empty side of the court with a no-look pass. And I think it was Grant Williams who hit the three. I'm like, what are you doing? But it works. You know, some of these the theatrics and some of the style of LaMelo Ball rubs people the wrong way. But I'm all for that style, especially when it comes to winning basketball games. They needed every bit of that. They only had 6 minutes of action in that game with LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller on the floor together. And they created magic. The one dunk that Brandon Miller had in traffic, outstanding. I'm so excited to see LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller play together. It is very concerning to me that the Houston Rockets let that happen on their home floor against a shorthanded Charlotte Hornets team. But LaMelo Ball, man, he is awesome.
Yeah, LaMelo, 34 points, 11 assists, 8 rebounds last night. He was absolutely unbelievable. Got wherever the hell he wanted on the floor, you know, hit the craziest shots, had the put back, you know, missed three layup like we mentioned earlier. I thought he was tremendous. And you have Trey Mann off the bench, and he was great. They had him with the ball in his hands a lot down the stretch of the game. And that's one of the things with LaMelo. LaMelo is this, you know, just absolutely glorious playmaker. Like, he's got flair. You mentioned the no looks. He makes the smart passes. He made the pass to Brandon Miller on that poster dunk for Jabari Smith on a cut. His intelligence is high level as a playmaker with the ball in his hands. But because he's a knockdown shooter, he can play off of others. And he's selfless. We've seen him set screens. We've seen him as a cutter. And we've seen him stand in the corner watching Trey Mann go off. So I think with this Hornets team, they have so many different points of attack, so many different shooters. And this is why, one of the reasons why I'm bullish on them is like, hey, maybe they get into the play-in and maybe they're actually a playoff team this year. So I was highly encouraged there. The opposite feelings compared to Houston, where, you know, welcome to the NBA for Reed Shepard. Fred VanVleet has to shoot 18 times in that game because they're not getting a lot of creation elsewhere. VanVleet, I like VanVleet. Sometimes he pisses me off. I feel like we saw his limitations in the game last night, where VanVleet, he can go get hot. He can, you know, just hit a ton of threes. But when he's not feeling it from three, the problem with VanVleet is he's not a guy who gets to the rim. And when he does, he's a 50% guy at the rim. That is not good. And he's not a guy who gets into the mid-range. And when he does, he's not good. He's like a 40% guy from mid-range. So if he's not hitting threes, he's not giving you a lot of plus offensive production. And I thought that was the case with Houston in last night's game. And, you know, if VanVleet's your best player, that does put a real cap on what your team is going to be.
And defensively, you know, LaMelo Ball, I think, cooked a lot in that game because Fred VanVleet just can't really do much against a guy that big. Too small, right?
Yep.
And what I also liked from LaMelo is his 10 free throws. You know, they in the Clifford era, they brought in referee consultants to help LaMelo Ball try to figure out how to get to the free throw line more, because he would attack the basket and he would do the early Derrick Rose thing where he would use his athleticism to avoid contact and have some amazing layups and finishes. But in order to make that leap, you got to be Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and recognize, I can use my athleticism to get to the free throw line. Or Jimmy Butler, players like that who were able to, DeMar DeRozan, where you're able to leverage some of that length and athleticism into getting easy points at the free throw line. So I think that was also effective for LaMelo Ball. And I want to say, Fred VanVleet didn't have his best game. I don't expect him to be a lockdown defender, but I expect more out of the defensive unit. I mean, the whole Houston Rockets team under Ime Udoka has to be better. The Charlotte Hornets shot 5 of 5 in the paint in the fourth quarter, 5 of 10 from downtown. Another thing, I know we're just going in on LaMelo Ball greatness. The other thing I did see that
he was unbelievable last night. We should be.
He might have been the best player in the NBA last night. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many times we've seen LaMelo Ball play that well, and it was in the season opener after a long layoff. So very impressed by also, there was this play where the Hornets had the ball, LaMelo Ball made this move, and he was alone at the three-point line by himself. There was no one within 20 feet, and he could have just taken a three wide open three. Instead, as someone closed out, he kicked it to Brandon Miller. Brandon Miller hit the three, got fouled, and they had a four-point play opportunity. Hmm. And that was just one of those moments when you say to yourself, like, the rap on him is that he isn't a winning player, that he's selfish, that he just plays only for himself. But when he's giving love to his new courtmate, Brandon Miller, trying to get him going, I love to see that. And it's just, I think, another sign that LaMelo Ball still, I think, has a lot to prove as a winning player, but he's doing these little things that I think Charles Lee, congrats to him. That was a great job by him in the season opener on the road in a tough building in Houston.
Yeah, any thoughts on Reed Sheppard with his debut?
I can't say I'm worried, but I thought his shot would be a lot more dynamite here in the early going. Preseason, he didn't have a shot going. It was, maybe I'm biased here. They looked like good misses, you know, like soft misses off the front of the rim or something like that. But
you're not thinking Jimmer, are you? You're not thinking Jimmer Fredette?
No. I'm still team Reed Sheppard. I feel like they need to get more of him on the floor. I don't think we have a Jimmer Fredette situation, but I do think, Kev, what is up with the rookie class?
Yeah, really. Everybody struggled. Everybody. Edie fouled out for Memphis.
No player, including Zach Edey, who fouled out, like you said, played more than 24 minutes in any of the games in the season opener. Not a single rookie.
Yeah.
Okay. The only two rookies that scored in double figures were not even picked in the top 20. Okay. So the lottery guys had fewer minutes than the second round picks in the season openers. So I'm wondering to you, because you're a draft guru and someone who spends a lot of time watching tape and understanding the talent levels in every class, do you think that's more indicative of how down the lottery talent is, or do you think it's indicative of how deep the class was in 2024?
I think it's a little bit of both. It is deep. I mean, like, you see Jalen Wells, he played a lot for Memphis. He's, you know, a little bit older, provides a clear cut skill with his shooting ability. So I think he's going to play more. Like Jamal Shedd, upperclassman. He's a, you know, lockdown defender, reliable point guard. So he's older, second round pick. He's going to play a little bit. And now New Orleans doesn't have a center. So like their late first round pick, Missy out of Baylor, they don't have a clear center. Missy looked great off the bench. Maybe he ends up starting over Daniel Tice at some point. So I think with some of these like non-lottery picks, it's these clear cut defined skills that is allowing them to play early on. And for some of the teams, it's circumstances. Like with Portland, they have DeAndre Ayton, a more veteran center. Donovan Clingan coming off the bench. Do they want to play with two bigs? Clearly not. Clearly they're just going to have Clingan ease in slowly to start the season. Dalton Knecht for the Lakers playing only 15 minutes. He was tremendous in those 15 minutes, I thought, for LA. Only played 15 minutes because they have a glut of veterans ahead of them. So I would expect that with some of these guys that were, you know, either lottery picks or top 20 picks, we'll see the minutes tick up over the course of the season. But it is also the other side of it, where there's no clear cut, you know, superstar prospect in this lottery, somebody that a team is going to say, we're going to invest 30 minutes in you every single night. Mm-hmm. Zachary Risacher is the number one pick going to Atlanta, played 19 minutes. He hit his first three, then missed everything else. Risacher is somebody they're going to ease in, I think. So I would anticipate that what we saw in the season opener probably will be a trend where these guys start to trend up slowly over the course of the season. Why do you think otherwise?
I saw how good Donovan Clingan was in the preseason, and he didn't have it going, but no one else on the Blazers really had it going. After the game, Chauncey Billups said not a single player played well. So this isn't just Donovan Clingan. I think it was a bad night for a lot of the Blazers, and I think Clingan's going to be much better going forward. I'm still a big believer in his talent. He had 14 points, 20 rebounds, 4 blocks, 4 assists against Utah. And like that just, I know it's preseason and vets aren't playing that hard, but man, I didn't suspect the rookie class to be this ineffective or less making their imprint on the NBA going into these opening nights. So I'm still team Reed Shepard, but I'm a little worried, and I'm hoping that Ime Udoka says, like, we need more shot creation. We need more, I don't know, stabilized offense. Alperen Şengün can't create everything for them as the hub. I hope that they play more Reed Shepard because 9 minutes was disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, they got to play him more. You just got to throw him out there. You mentioned Donovan Klingon and the Blazers. Let's talk more about the Blazers in a second. But first, I want to remind listeners to subscribe to the Kevin O'Connor Show if you haven't done so already. It really does help out if you do that. All right, Tom, you mentioned the Blazers. I want to play a little game for this segment here called Fat Fiction or Fantasy. Fact would mean you agree with the statement that I share. Okay. Fiction means you think the statement is completely false. And fantasy, you believe the statement might be a bit of a stretch, but maybe it could pan out. We'll see. That all sound good? Fact, fiction, or fantasy?
Let's do it.
Okay. All right. Let's start out with the Blazers. They lost 139-104 on Wednesday night against the Warriors. Scoot Henderson entering the fourth quarter in that game. He had 13 points. He was 4 of 13 from the floor. This is entering the fourth quarter, and then it was garbage time. He went off in the fourth quarter. You can read into that if you want to. I come away still feeling a bit concerned with Scoot. I know you see the flashes when he pulls up from mid-range sometimes, but the drives to the rim, Tom, like, I feel like he's just struggling to find angles and create space in the ways that we kind of hoped for when we saw him playing for the Ignite. So our first fact, fiction, or fantasy, Scoot Henderson will never be able to deliver the expectations that the Blazers had set for him.
Oh, I'm going false there. He's 20 years old. I'm not concerned to the level of saying he can never get there. However, I do think that the Blazers are expecting him to take a big leap this year from the three-point shot, from the pull-ups. But I think the drives to the rim are good. He's getting to the rim. It's just finishing. There has to be a sense of purpose when you're up in the air, or a sense of what I'm going to be doing here, a roadmap for him mentally to, you know, kind of get through the thicket of all the defenders who are trying to block his shot. He's got the athleticism. He's got the lift. It's just a little bit of the touch when he gets up to the rim to just figure out a way to lay it in. You know, like Derrick Rose, Allen Iverson, these guys were elite at getting to the rim, but also their touch around the rim. It was a beauty to behold. And I think that's the next layer for a 20-year-old Scoot Henderson figure out that touch around the rim.
He's got to figure it out, but also he's like, Derrick Rose is an elite of the elite athlete. Scoot's a good athlete. He's speedy, he's strong, he's like a great football athlete. But you know, from terms of vertical leap, he is not Derrick Rose. He is not Ja Morant. And Allen Iverson is so much more quick and shifty off the dribble with the lateral movements. So I think with Scoot, that's where the concern is with me. But at the same time, with Portland, you have Anfernee Simons starting ahead of him. You now have Shaedon Sharpe and Scoot Henderson, who are going to be coming off the bench together once Shaedon Sharpe comes back. I'd like to see Portland. I mean, I like Simons, but maybe you flip Simons and you just go all in on the investment in Scoot. If you really believe in Scoot, I don't think you want him being a guy who's playing garbage time. They're getting smoked. Like, the stats were padded. He finished with 22 points on 18 shots, but the game entering the fourth quarter was just not very impressive from the Scoot Henderson side of things. And so yes, he's young. I'm not giving up. He's a hard worker. He's a really good kid. He's going to do everything he can to maximize his potential. That's why, like, I kind of come away feeling, maybe Portland's just got too many guys ahead of him. Is that more fair than saying that he won't live up, but maybe there's too much blocking him?
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic with Anfernee Simons, who I think is too small to play full-time two guard, and he's the first one to admit, like, defensively, he has a lot of room to grow on that end of the floor to be able to guard twos or bigger players, and he's so good at creating that gravity As the ball handler, he's such a good deep three-point shooter that he makes others better around him by virtue of just drawing two to the ball. And so you want that guy to have the ball in his hands. And Scoot Henderson, I think it's a lot of it is just confidence. I think a lot of it, Chauncey Billups threw him into the fire in the beginning of last season saying, hey, you're our guy. You're our the face of our franchise. We're going to start you. We're going to play you, 30, 35 minutes against the NBA's best. And now they're taking a different tack, which is like, hey, let's have you anchor that second unit, play with Donovan Klingon, develop that chemistry. And that's the way that they're going to go here going forward. And I do think that confidence will go a long way for a young player who's 20 years old, like I said, who's struggling to find his groove. I do think that, you know, he does need to see the ball go through the basket a couple times in order for him to get going. And maybe coming off the bench will give him more opportunities to do that.
0 of 5 from 3 in the season opener for Scoot. On the other side of that, the Warriors went with a 12-man rotation, something a little different. Steve Kerr said after the game that he couldn't justify taking anyone out, which is fair. I mean, like, I think with this Warriors team, they have 10 guys that are like the 7th best player on a roster, and he says he's going to stick with it. And I thought it was really, really, really interesting what Stephen Curry said after the game. Steph was asked about, you know, what does it mean to you to like be selfless, after he had talked about there's been great energy from training camp, everybody knows you're going to get opportunity, and Steph had a really, really interesting answer when he was asked, how do you define a healthy ego? What he said was, believing that you're an impactful player out on the court and you have a certain skill set you can showcase every single night, but it's not your night. You're not sticking out like a sore thumb with pouting or complaining, woe is me. The NBA is a tough job. It's a tough environment. For our team to be successful, everybody has to bring their best self and, again, commit to the group. I share all that to say, fact, fiction, or fantasy, this Warriors 12-man rotation is going to keep everybody fresh and happy, so much so that other teams begin to start adapting this into their own rotations. Deeper rotations with a deeper league.
Is this just another form of load management, Kev?
I think it could be. Could also be shots at Clay from Stephen Curry. I don't want to go there, but I don't want to go there. Could be shots at Clay. I don't want to go there, but it could be shots at Clay.
It could be load management too. Or it could be, you know, Kuminga or any of the other young guys who, you know, he and the rest of the organization want to be on the same page about, you know, the goals for this franchise and putting your ego aside. Like, that's a message for the locker room and maybe someone else's locker room. I'm not so sure.
I mean, but Clay was crying and whining all of last year. It is a dramatic change from last season where you have Clay pouting on the bench. And then this year you have 12 guys playing in the primary rotation before garbage time late in the game when they put in their others. 12 dudes.
Yeah. Do you think it's like a showcase for a trade? Because I can't imagine this continues. Like, I know Greg Popovich, you know.
So you're saying fiction or fantasy for this?
Good. Thank you for bringing that up. I totally blew that. I'm going to go with fiction. I think this is a showcase for trying to consolidate like 3 or 4 rotation guys into another star for the Golden State Warriors. I know that they struck out on Lauri Markkanen. Draymond Green had suggested that they were going after both Paul George and Markkanen in the offseason, which is bold. I mean, we've seen many bold transactions over the years.
They weren't getting both. Never were getting both. Draymond's delusional.
Draymond? Draymond not seeing things straight here? Okay. He's, you know, like he also got attacked, by the way, in that game. And it just, you shouldn't be getting attacked in those situations. In game one, you got to understand, like, it's not worth it. You know, it's not worth it. It's the first game. And it's not like it was nationally televised where you're jacked up for the game and the tensions are high, the emotions are high. Hey, I didn't say that. I didn't say that, Kevin. But point taken. I do think there's this other piece, this other layer of what Steve Kerr and Stephen Curry are trying to do this year is, you know, like in order to get the best out of Moses Moody and Jonathan Kuminga and Buddy Hield, by the way, Buddy Hield's awesome. He was kind of the spark, this energy, this positive energy that maybe they were lacking with Clay last year. And I do think that contract, you know, $37 million over 4 years, it could end up looking like a steal if he outperforms the Clay Thompson contract and anchors that second unit. Like, it reminded me a lot of Jordan Poole, good Jordan Poole for the Golden State Warriors, where it was like, he's instant offense and he's just is different energy than Draymond, than Steph. He is just going to be unfiltered going for buckets. And man, I think the stat is he's had more three-pointers than any other player in the NBA over the last 5 years. So like, we know that he can get buckets, but the energy that he brings is something that they were missing last year and that I think counts for something. But I do think like a consolidating trade where they four quarters for a dollar, I do think that this is kind of part of that plan at some point. It's just, who is that player?
Yeah, who is that player? And that might not manifest until January or February as teams figure out who they are. One team on opening night on Tuesday, the Knicks trailed at one point by 35 points. They lost 132 to 109. Celtics attacked Cat right out of the gates. Mikal Bridges with his ugly broken jumper was only 2 of 7 from three. Fact, fiction, or fantasy, Tom? The Celtics have already exposed the Knicks as phony contenders.
Oh, I'm going fantasy. Yeah, I think you're onto something, but I'm not quite there. Mikal Bridges, the broken jumper, is getting to the point that this might be one of the worst trades of all time if he can't get that jumper back. And like, Mikal Bridges was brought in to be a stopper for the Boston Celtics. And it was the greatest offensive display in the history of basketball, John Naismith included, like all the way dating back. That Boston Celtics inferno was insane. And I like Josh Hart being like, yo, we got to drug test those guys. That was unbelievable. But Mikal Bridges and OG Anunoby were brought in to stop that. And they could do nothing.
And Celtics went at Bridges too. He was brought into a lot of on-ball screens. They were not afraid to say, hey, Mikal Bridges, you traded 5 first-round picks on a swap to go get this guy. We don't care. We're going to attack him.
Exactly. So it's not just the shot. It's the defense. If he's not providing that, you know, all defensive team hands from one side of the floor to the next and just being able to put opponents into a straitjacket, then Mikal Bridges is just another guy. So I think this is alarming for the Knicks. I think it's also alarming that we're talking about a team that was built on offensive rebounds last year and just playing bully ball. Yeah. They didn't really have that kind of identity. And so I think you're having an identity crisis from the jump. If Tom Thibodeau wants this team to be a real title contender, they need to get better performance out of guys like Mikal Bridges. And I got to say, Cat, like, he's going to be a lightning rod this season. I don't think everything was on Cat in that opening night loss.
No, of course not. I don't think everything was on Cat either. I think on the Knicks side of things, we talk about their new acquisitions with Cat and Bridges, but also Boston had Cornette defending Josh Hart for periods of the game. They were just not worried about Josh Hart shooting. It felt like a spacing issue at times for the Knicks, even though they added Cat, a center who does shoot, who is the self-proclaimed greatest shooting center ever. The Celtics said instead, oh, we'll just help off the other guy who struggles to shoot. That's what happened in that game. And if Hart's going to play, you know, 50 minutes a game under Tom Thibodeau, that means there's one guy on the floor at all times that at least Boston and other teams is going to just ignore when he's behind the arc.
Yeah, Boston's going to do this to about 10 teams this year, is going to force teams to question everything. And the Knicks, after that opening night loss, I was questioning everything. Like, were we just so wrong about this team and their ability to defend and Karl-Anthony Towns? And the only glimmering part of that team was Deuce McBride, and he's coming off the bench, right? So like, you need the 5 stars to play like 5 stars, and Deuce McBride can't be your best player every single night.
No, he can't be, and he wasn't that first game. I think I'm not giving up on the Knicks, to be clear, but that was concerning, to say the least. And it's concerning in part because of how tremendous Boston looked. I think that was more about Boston being as great as they are. I had said earlier in the offseason that I don't believe Boston is some juggernaut, that they can be taken down, they can be defeated, and I don't think they're necessarily at like the KD, Steph, Clay, Draymond Warriors level of juggernaut. That's the bar I'm talking about when I use the word juggernaut. but they're pretty freaking good, dude. Like, they are pretty good. And so I think for the Knicks side of things, that's a really, really high bar to have to match. And you mentioned they bring in Bridges. They have OG Anunoby for Tatum and Brown. The thing is Tatum is so much more of a shot creator. Like, that cross-court pass he had to Derek White earlier in that game, just absolutely gorgeous, man. Like, he's not just a bucket getter. He's an elite defender. He's an elite rebounder. And he's become a really, really good passer, too. So it's not like he just needs to score. We already saw that they won the finals when he didn't score. And Brown wasn't even efficient in the finals for that matter either, compared to what he can be at his peak levels. So, yeah, Boston looked tremendous. Knicks, not so much. On Wednesday night, Tom, we saw the Magic and the Heat face off against each other, another Eastern Conference battle between two not, you know, top-level contenders, but two really good teams. Well, the Magic blew them out, 116-97. Banchero looks awesome, 33 points, 11 rebounds, 3 assists. Franz Wagner had 23 points, hit some corner threes. That looked good. He also locked up Jimmy Butler, who was 1 of 8 in the game. So here's my fact, fiction, or fantasy question for you for this game. The Orlando Magic have surpassed the Miami Heat as the best team in Florida.
Ooh, I'll go with fact. You don't do that on Pat Riley's night. You know, like, the Miami Heat can't have that happen on Pat Riley's night, where they're honoring the Godfather and they're opening the season on their home floor. They've heard a lot of talk about Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo, and then they do that dud. Like, that can't happen. And you know what? Orlando played the defensive brand of basketball that we expect from the Miami Heat. So I hope that Pat Riley came down from his seat, went into that locker room, and tore him a new one. Like, I think the Miami Heat were embarrassed. And I think Bam Adebayo said that after the game. It was embarrassing what they did in the season opener against Orlando. Orlando played the brand of basketball that the Miami Heat usually do, right? The Heat culture we keep talking about, that's what Orlando brought in that one game. And it's 1 out of 82. But if we're going to put Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo on this pedestal of being two legit stars who are can anchor a title team, then we do also have to keep that standard of when they go 2 of 13 against the Orlando Magic, we got to hammer them. We got to. And so the Miami Heat were teetering on this, like, are they real contenders? And I do think that they're contenders eventually. But after that game, I don't see how you watch that and think that the Orlando Magic are a worse outfit than the Miami Heat. It's just, I don't know. It was such a statement game on Pat Riley's night on their home floor. You had every reason for the Miami Heat to just clobber him, and it was the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, it was. And I felt like with Orlando, they shot a hell of a lot of threes. Over half their shots were threes as well. You had Franz hitting threes from the corner. Very encouraging after his, you know, really cold stretch ever since February of last season and through the Olympics and through preseason. Banchero, I mean, he looked like the best player on the floor. Like you said, Butler and Bam Adebayo, if you're stacking them up, you know, lining them all up and you're picking them in order of best player to worst player, most people are taking Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo first, before anybody else, before any Orlando Magic player. But Paolo Banchero made a really, really, really good case in that game. He had the beautiful pass to a cutter at the rim. He hit some pull-up threes. He looked like LeBron light is what he looked like for Orlando. And if he continues taking another step forward, he's gotten better in each of his first two seasons. If Banchero becomes top 15, top 20 level player, I think people are going to talk a lot differently about Banchero. And for what it's worth, I say top 15, top 20. That could be conservative when you talk about a guy at 6'10" with his playmaking ability, with his shot creation ability. He looked like a top 5 guy, at least in that first game against the Miami Heat, I felt like.
Yeah, he was outstanding. It was everything that Heat fans wanted to see from Bam Adebayo and Jimmy Butler in the season opener. You can't have Jimmy Butler going 0-for-1 in the second half. Like, I know he didn't play all that
barely
much,
shot.
Like,
he just didn't even test Wagner. He didn't even go at him. Like there's so many times Butler was just standing in the corner, just wasn't even testing.
Yeah, and not only that, like, when he would drive against KCP, KCP would make the great defensive play to stop him. And I know KCP didn't have a great offense at night, but this is why they got him.
But good
to have another lockdown defender against a guy like Jimmy Butler.
Exactly. I mean, I thought KCP, like you said, he didn't shoot the ball well. Everybody else on Orlando did. KCP still was a super positive player for them in that season opener. We also saw the Cavaliers face off against the Raptors. They won by 30 points on Toronto's home floor. Evan Mobley had 25 points. Fact, fiction, or fantasy, Evan Mobley's leap is real, and it gives the Cavaliers East Finals potential.
Ooh, fantasy. I'm not going to say it's false. I'm not going to go as far to say as it's true that I totally agree with it. But Evan Mobley, I kind of feel like this is his moment here to start stealing some of the spotlight and say this is his team. You know, like Donovan Mitchell is the great scorer, one of the best two guards in the NBA. But I do think that this could be Evan Mobley's team. Like going forward, he's not the all-star yet. That's Darius Garland. That's Donovan Mitchell. That's Jared Allen. They've all been all-stars at this point in their career. But after that game, there's a strong case that Evan Mobley could be their best player on the Cleveland Cavaliers. And if they get, you know, everybody on the same page, and they're a weird team where their best lineups last year were not when you'd expect, you know, like all their star players on the floor, it wasn't gangbusters last year. And so I do think that they still have some chemistry issues that they're going to have to figure out for them to reach that upper tier. But then again, man, the Indiana Pacers made the Eastern Conference Finals last year. And if all those top teams are as injury prone or as brittle as they are on paper, I do think that the Cleveland Cavaliers have a shot at getting to the East Finals. But I just need to see a little bit more from Evan Mobley, or a little bit more consistency under Kenny Atkinson, the new head coach there, for me to really put them in the title contender.
I think that's very fair. I would say fantasy as well with Cleveland. The one thing I will say in support of the argument for Cleveland is that Kenny Atkinson wants to empower Evan Mobley to be that player. And like he had an interview with Wob, and he posted this, I think it was with SiriusXM, and he said like, yeah, we want Mobley to be that guy. Like, we're going to empower him to be that guy. We need him to be that guy. And they played him like it. Like the different types of actions they run him through. Sometimes he's handling the ball in a pick and roll. He's attacking it off of an isolation on the right wing. He can, of course, as a typical big man, set screens and roll. He can pop. He can run out and transition. They just have him playing in such a diverse set of different actions. Kenny Atkinson, a coach who I think is very good with X's and O's. He was going back to his days with Brooklyn. He was very good with the Warriors as well. Added a nice ingredient to that Warriors coaching staff. I think he's going to be really good for Evan Mobley. And it won't surprise me if we see Evan Mobley have the best season of his career one bit. Whether that translates into East Finals or not, there's so many different variables that go into that. But Cleveland, I think they're a greater threat than perhaps we might realize, considering the potential for an Evan Mobley leap. I mean, we saw it last year in the playoffs, Tom. Like, the way he closed out their season and then the way he performed in the playoffs, the only thing is was that was without Jared Allen. And so I think doing it with all the guys out there, that's going to be the challenge for the Cavaliers.
His usage rate in that game, 28%. His usage rate pretty much every year up to this point in his career is 20%. So you go from 20%, which is basically average. If there's five players on the floor and you add up 20 plus 20 plus 20 plus 20 plus 20, that's 100% usage by your team. He's average, basically another guy, a role player, essentially, for the Cleveland Cavaliers up to this point. But at 28%, that's a right at the borderline of star go-to guy offensively. And for the Cavaliers to reach their potential, they need that. They need Evan Mobley to be at 28%. And it does sound like Kenny Atkinson wants him to be there too.
One of the best games of Wednesday night was the Clippers and the Suns. The Clippers lost to the Suns in overtime, 116 to 113. But they did open up Intuit Dome, Steve Ballmer's new arena in Los Angeles. In the fourth quarter, there's a moment where the ESPN broadcast cut to the wall while Kevin Durant was at the free throw line. Fans are going crazy. It looks like a European soccer game. And then KD missed both free throws. And then after the game, KD said in his interview, it's probably the best arena he's been in. And he congratulated Ballmer for it. So fact, fiction, or fantasy? The Clippers are going to go from having one of the worst home crowds in sports to one of the best in the NBA.
Fact. I'm
Fact.
All about it.
Wow.
I'm
You're buying.
Wow. I'm buying it. I'm buying all the stock in the Intuit Dome. I'm loving this. I think NBA environments are so sterile in the sense that like everything is so homogenous. Every arena, by and large, feels like the same thing. Whereas in other sports, we don't have that at all. We have different climate variables in the NFL, the dome, or playing in outdoor temperatures where you have Lambeau Field, you're playing in a foot of snow, or in Buffalo. There are these like environmental changes that make your home court or your home field feel like it's yours, right? You don't have that in the NBA. Every NBA arena, it just seems like it is a carbon copy of the other NBA arenas. And so in baseball, like the Houston Astros put a hill in center field with a foul pole in the middle of it. Like Yes. They put a pole, a flagpole in the middle of a hill in center field for like 20 years.
Like, or like Boston, I grew up going to see games and you have the Green Monster, this massive 37-foot-tall wall in left field. And then they put seats on top of the wall at one point, and I sat up there. It's awesome.
So you and I, both Red Sox fans, grew up in New England, worshiping at the altar of the Green Monster. How are you not a fan of the wall? The wall is great. We need more of that. Like here in Charlotte, we have Charlotte FC and we have a supporter section that is for free. You can go to the game for free and just sit in the supporter section. And it's a great vibe. We need more Cameron Indoor Stadium vibes in the NBA. It is going more corporate, not more fan friendly. And I do think this is a great way for not just the Clippers to gain an advantage. I want everybody to see what the Clippers are doing and Steve Ballmer doing. And try to copy that and do something really cool in their arena, because I just think it's too homogenous in the NBA.
I just hope the Clippers are competitive enough for those fans to continue having something to cheer about, because that was a great game. It was a great game. The Clippers defense, they were flying around, they were competitive. Harden was getting buckets. Look, like, I don't know when or how much Kawhi is going to play once he does return, but the Clippers at least looked like a team that's easy to root for, even if they're just a play-in team or even if they're not a play-in team. They at least looked fun to me, a fun team to root for with great energy. So I don't know if I'd go all the way at saying like one of the best home courts in the NBA, because that means you're competing against Boston and New York. But the competition is not necessarily great when it comes to home crowds. There's a lot of quiet arenas around the NBA. So can the Clippers be one of the 10 best home courts in the NBA? I think that's very possible. It really is.
Oh, come on. Come on. Yes, it's going to happen. Yes. It's going to happen. It's now going to be a storyline. Like, I am going to track this, Kevin. I am going to track opponent free throw percentage in front of the wall going forward this season. I want to see if Devin Booker and Kevin Durant missing free throws is a legit thing that they can gain an advantage going forward.
It's a future big number episode. A future big number episode. You just launched your new podcast, right, Tom, on Thursday on the Yahoo Sports NBA feed with Dan Devine. Big number with Tom Haverstroh. Is that true?
You know what? It is true. Every Thursday, you're going to see the big number at Yahoo Sports. It was a 2 to 3 minute video that I would do for Yahoo, but now it's being extended a bigger, big number every week coming out on Thursdays. Subscribe. That was an amazing lob you threw. It was almost like a LaMelo lob to Miles Bridges. It was very, very seamless. Thank you for that lob. But yeah, every Thursday, we just talked about big men centers shooting threes and whether we buy or sell the notion that, you know, Bam Adebayo, DeAndre Ayton, Anthony Davis shooting and making threes. It actually was in part due to your column that you had written where you said we're going to see a lot of.
You're not buying it
only because history tells us,
yes.
And this is a little tease here, 79% of new 3-point shots from centers in the preseason fade away. They just usually revert back to their norms. Old habits die hard. It's really hard for these big men to start shooting threes, but you know what? I'm rooting for it. I think it's more fun that way.
So go listen to the big number as soon as you click off this podcast. If you haven't listened to it already, maybe you already have. Last thing before we get you out of here, Tom, with that Clippers team, we saw in that opening night in the game, no Kawhi, Paul George is gone. He's in Philadelphia now. It was the Harden show. He had 94 touches in the game. He had possession of the ball for 10 minutes. That was the most of anybody in the entire league from their
That's
first games.
Number.
Yep. That's a huge number. And just for perspective with that number, during the 18-19 season, when Harden averaged 36 points per game, he possessed the ball for 9.2 minutes per game average. So 10 minutes is a hell of a lot for Harden. Last season, he averaged only 16.6 points per game. He hasn't averaged over 25 since the 19-20 season. If there were a comeback player of the year award, Tom, fact, fiction, or fantasy, James Harden would win that comeback player of the year.
Ooh, we've got so many. The Ball family has that cornered, that market. So I feel like we're going to look at James Harden being comeback player. I don't know if comeback is the right word, because it's like he's already been an MVP. He's already been a scoring leader. But I kind of feel
points
like
per game is he might be a 25 plus guy again this year, just by virtue of the fact that no Kawhi for who knows how long.
Yeah. We could be looking at like Zubats, point guard Zubats for long periods of stretches if James Harden gets hurt. So they need this. They need James Harden to go back to D'Antoni Harden for them to compete on a nightly basis. It's just when you're talking about a guy who's 35 years old, like that prime Harden years, that was what, 5-6 years ago. And so can his body hold up? And you saw like the mental mistakes there at the end in overtime where he drops the pass. Feels like that's something that was like, that's like just a total random thing. But I kind of feel like that's when you're fatigued, you're tired, and maybe you just that little take your eye off the ball and you lose the game.
He also doesn't get to the basket the way he did before or draw fouls the way he did before. He's actually like in a league where everybody's shooting threes now. Harden has finally, he's brought back the mid-range. He is taking pull-up mid-range jumpers because he's not getting the basket as much anymore. But Harden becoming more of a, even more of a jump shooter with threes and mid-range rather than threes and layups. It's a new, different type of James Harden at this point of his career, but it's fun. I had fun watching that Clippers-Suns game. I had a good time, and I want to go to an Intuit Dome game. You got to come out to L.A. at some point, Tom. We got to go to a game.
Yes, we got to go to the Wall. We got to experience why it's the number one fan experience in the NBA now. And you know what? It's not a high bar to clear. It just feels like every NBA arena feels like the same thing, more or less. And I love the idea of creating some sort of cool dynamic for the fans. And especially without Kawhi, no Paul George. Like, yeah, do something weird. I want more weird.
Well, Tom, thanks for joining me, as you will, every Friday this NBA season. Have a good day, man.
Thanks, Kev.
Thanks to Tom Haverstraw for joining the Kevin O'Connor Show. Thanks to Gibson Piper as well from Half Court Hoops. Thanks to John and Brett and the entire team for working hard behind the scenes to make the show happen. We need mailbag questions for next week. Hit me up at kocshow@yahoosports.com. Send video notes, voice memos. We'll take written questions as well. We'll be doing that mailbag again next Tuesday. Please be sure to subscribe as well. Appreciate you. Have a good weekend. Enjoy the NBA games.